hearing, of course, a lot about police reform. And I know today and over the weekend, a big topic of conversation has been defunding the police. And that's what we're going to talk about for the next 30 minutes until 8 o'clock. If you're sick of talking about it, I promise we've got other things coming up. We've got a stress expert that's going to be joining us. We have an award-winning author from Libertyville, Illinois, a fascinating story of as she was starting to research her family history, you know, the genealogy. And I know all of us are sort of doing those genealogy kits right now, trying to figure out more about her family. She discovered a big family secret in her life, and that's also coming up. But if you're not tired of talking about it and want to join the conversation, of course, your phone calls are always welcome, 312-981-7200. So yeah, we're going to be talking about defunding the police and police reform in the next 30 minutes, sort of unpacking what that means. I know that it can sound super radical and downright frightening, honestly, but we're going to unpack that with a Washington Post reporter who's been covering it nationally coming up. But right now, joining us, we're so lucky to have with us Michael Tabman. He's a national speaker. He's also an author. He is a retired FBI agent, but he was also a police officer and a hostage negotiator. And we're just thrilled to have you with us, Michael. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, my goodness. Did I describe your bio properly? You've done so many things.
Good enough for me, yes. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm sure, obviously, you have been keeping up with everything that's happening in the country, and I just kind of wanted to get your generalized thoughts. I know that defunding the police can mean various things. I mean, it can literally mean, to some people, getting rid of the police altogether, but it seems to a majority of people mean sort of reallocating resources and lowering the funding that's sent to police. What do you think about that?
Right. I don't think anyone can seriously consider defunding in the sense of what the word means, which is just cutting off funds and is, in essence, dismantling the police department. I think the terminology is a response, an emotional response born of angst and anxiety over what we're seeing unfold before our eyes. And it's an emotional term that I think is going to evoke a lot of response. But as you said, I don't think it's going to actually be that drastic in terms of eliminating police departments. So if a jurisdiction, a city or county, wants to reallocate funds that could be used more effectively or more efficiently in another activity or another function, well, that's sound fiscal policy. But if they're going to cut off money to the police department as a form of punishment, that will backfire and that will fail.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about it in those terms. Do you think that there's sound reasoning? I mean, you are somebody. You're a retired FBI agent. I mean, we're on a police force. You were a hostage negotiator. Do you think that there's a sound reasoning behind saying, hey, we need to look at how we're spending our budgets and how much money we're spending on our police departments?
I think it's fair to look at that, but I don't think the focus should be on money. We're going to defund, because again, to me, it sounds more like, you know, we're giving you a spanking. We're going to take away your money. I think the concept of police reform would be much more responsive to the problems we're having now. And that is change the police culture, because certainly I know from my years in law enforcement, you know, the reputation of being tough and being able to stand up to people and knowing, you know, how to kind of push the envelope is kind of within that culture. It's sort of respected. We want to move away from that. We want to get to more community policing, which police departments have done throughout the country. We need to get back to that. And that's going to come in through effective leadership and guidance at the very top levels of our government and the police department itself.
Speaking with national speaker and author and former FBI agent and police officer Michael Tabman. Michael, we've heard a lot about community policing. It's been something that's, you know, been attempted for so long. What's the problem? Why hasn't it manifested itself in a way that, you know, and copied nationally in a way that's successful?
Right. You know, it's funny, not really in a humorous way. I think back when I was a police officer in Fairfax County, Virginia, which just today I saw a tape of a Fairfax County officer abusing the use of the taser, at least so it appeared, and he was charged. It was very disheartening to me to see that, because we had a reputation for professionalism, nationwide reputation. But I remember once in a while, when asked to do the community policing, was to get out of the car and walk around the neighborhood. And I did that, and people come up to me, what's wrong? Why are you out of the car? Why are you walking around? And it made them more nervous sometimes than just seeing that off patrol. I think we have to remember police are viewed in this authoritarian role. People see them. They don't see them as someone that have friendly purposes. Most interactions people can have with the police are limited to someone being in trouble or needing help, but not just to chew the fat and you know, just kind of socialize with. So I think we see them in this role. Police see themselves in this role, sort of when you're a hammer, the whole world's a nail. And I think, again, that comes down to changing the culture, understanding that, yes, the taxpayer is your customer or is your boss, really. They are paying for your service. Mm-hmm. And we have to ingrain that within starting at the recruit level, that you're not there to walk around and say, who's going to break my law? You're there saying, how can I help?
Right.
More customer service, community relations. And that is going to take a major shift in the culture of police work.
And as you said, because you know firsthand, that's going to take a major shift. Is that something, does that mean that training has to be completely reconceptualized? How, and continual training as well?
Well, I think continual training is important. But yes, you start with the police academy. And I don't think it has to be reconceptualized because, as you pointed out, this is not a new concept. Mm-hmm. I think maybe it needs to be reemphasized and remind everybody, this is how you have to act as an officer. You're not there to be a tough guy. You're not there to abuse people. You're there to serve the public. And at times that may require the use of force or the use of deadly force, but not to push people around, not to exercise your authority over them. So that starts in the academy. But then you are right about having to continue it, because in my social media posts, I've got a number of questions from people saying, is this burnout by police? Mm-hmm. Is this compassion burnout? Have they lost the ability to be compassionate? And I think that is true. I remember just 2 years into being a police officer, I went back to an in-service and we discussed burnout. And some of us said, wow, we've only been on the job 2 years and we're starting to get signs of that. Because you are dealing with people complaining every day.
Well, I mean,
a lot of times... I'm sorry.
I just think about burnout for civilian jobs where our lives aren't on the line. I can't even imagine, you know, doing what police officers do. I mean, it seems as though there definitely needs to be more support in terms of mental and emotional support and more recovery time.
Absolutely. And I think that has certainly come a long way in the years since I stepped out as a police officer 40 years ago, if you can believe that. Even then, we had a police psychologist. And I can't imagine there's a police department of any size that doesn't have access to mental health for their police officers. But that has to be addressed in a way where the officer is comfortable getting help. Hmm. One, again, it goes to culture. No one likes to admit they're weak in any way, and that's how they see it, especially in the police culture. And two, in a way that they feel is not going to come back and hurt their career. Now they can't get promoted. Now they can't get a certain position because they sought some mental health help. So that has to be tread lightly and delicately, but it has to be available and it has to be promoted and officers have to be willing to use it.
Former police officer and FBI agent Michael Tabman, he's also an author and also a national speaker. Michael, can you willing to take a listener call right now?
Absolutely.
Okay. Hey, Ron, it's G. You're live on the air. What's your question for Michael?
Yeah, hey, Michael, I heard the Attorney General on earlier. One of the things that's being discussed around the country is that police should be licensed. Because what they're finding that is the police are committing some of these horrific acts. And even if they get fired, they go and they can get a job somewhere else, unlike a doctor, unlike a lawyer. But the thing is, when you talk about culture, without any kind of monetary cost, it doesn't change. And I'll say this real quick. I remember the whole thing with drinking and driving. That culture changed when it cost you your license and things like that. So if there's no cost to these police officers, they will continue to do it. So I just want to find out what's your opinion on licensing them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron, for your question. Michael, did you hear Ron's question there?
I did. It was an excellent question. Thank you, Ron. I think Ron is talking about the database, a national database that's been proposed, whereby if an officer is dismissed for cause, that they can then, they, the new employer, the new police department. So he's fired on Police Department A. Police Department A has to enter that into a database. So then when Officer Tabman applies to Police Department B, they can run that name in the database and see that he was dismissed from that department and then maybe not be eligible for rehire.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I say that is certainly if someone's been dismissed and for evidence of abuse of power, excessive force, taking gratuities, they might obviously not be eligible. But the policing power still rests within the state, and that's per our Constitution. And states and small towns that have trouble hiring police officers may want to have some leniency and say, well, he was dismissed for something that we don't feel was a major violation, or we feel that he could be rehabilitated, or we don't feel the evidence warranted his dismissal, because keep in mind, some of this is political, and we know that. So I don't think it'll be foolproof, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. And from most of the major city police chiefs that I've heard on the news, they all seem to support that idea.
Michael, can you hang on for just like 2 minutes here with me? Because I wanted to ask you about the immediate reforms that the mayor here in Chicago wants to complete in 90 days. And I want to see, I want you to answer how reasonable that might be. Do you mind hanging on? Can you?
I don't mind.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. A lot more with Michael Tabman. He is a former police officer and an FBI agent. And I also want to make sure that he tells you what books he's written too, because they're a good read. All that coming up. Let's continue our conversation with former police officer and FBI agent Michael Tabman. He's also an author and a national speaker. And if you have a question for him, call 312-981-7200. We'll try to get your question in. So, Michael, here in Chicago, the mayor has basically put out reforms that she wants to have happen. She's hoping to enact measures within 90 days, including police reform for training. And part of that training includes bringing the community into the police academy as teachers. So officers would receive training from members of the community, history of the neighborhoods where they'll serve. And so that way they can understand the history of the people living in the neighborhood that they'll be serving and protecting. Do you think that that is realistic? Do you think that's something that can actually be part of reform?
Yes, I think that can be part of reform, and I think it sounds like a great idea. Bring in some of the community and let them, again, speak about the history, speak about their culture. Let them know things that have happened in the past that officers have done that have either appeared offensive or threatening, even though the officer may not have meant it, and have that interaction. I know from my work when I was a special, so happens I was the special agent in charge of the Minneapolis office.
Mm-hmm.
I reported about 15 years ago, quite a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a long time ago, but we were big on the Citizens Academy, which I think you may have heard of, where we bring citizens in once a week for X number of weeks, and we present to them what we do. And, of course, they would always give us feedback, and it was a great opportunity to get to know the leaders in the community. This was often, you know, business leaders, not the average person, unfortunately, but it helped us establish sort of that presence there on a personal level. And I think in a police academy environment, you know, citizens academy environment, offering that, and in reverse, having these citizens come into the police academy, I think would start great dialogue and really go a long way to improving community relations.
That's a good point in terms of cultural differences that you experienced as well. Something else that the mayor also mentioned that she hopes to enact is sort of a mandated crisis intervention and procedural justice training for all officers. And I think we've heard so much about de-escalation, like providing real tools for officers. Do you think that currently there's enough training in de-escalation or no?
Well, interestingly, I was involved in training police officers in crisis intervention when I was a student at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. So, again, that concept is not a new one. And I remember working with that through our police academy and through the FBI academy. But clearly, from what we see unfolding in front of us, there has not been enough training in crisis intervention, which in of itself includes de-escalation. It's how to get in there and bring the temperature down and not have to resort to physical force to resolve the situation. So yes, we need more training in that, and I think we have to develop better expertise. And with that crisis intervention training, officers have to have the resources to make referrals. And I've heard, you know, some of these suggestions. I look mostly at the Minneapolis board, because they're the ones that are sort of the progenitors of this idea.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about mental health issues, and do we need police officers responding to mental health issues? Mm-hmm. When I was a young officer, I remember we had to serve what we called at the time mental petitions. I would imagine that offensive term is no longer used, but that's what we called them then. But we had to bring people into custody. Now, I could tell you it was a very unpleasant thing to do. None of us wanted to do it. And if you took that off the hands of the police, they'd probably appreciate that. But comes the issue is those things often turn violent. Very few people want to be taken into custody, and that's sort of when they break bad. So who is going to do that? Can you really do that without a trained armed officer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, you were talking about sort of, and you've mentioned this, longstanding police culture and that changing. And obviously, de-escalation is something that's already being taught. But what about it isn't making it through? And I think that's what you're speaking to, too.
Right. That's the question. And, you know, if I was to take over a police department now and they said reform it for us to happen, there are several things I would look at. And one of the things I would look at is the training in the academy, as you talked about, the in-service training. And then I would take a look at the culture of this police department. Mm-hmm. Is this something where managers, sergeants, lieutenants, and captains are encouraging de-escalation and not giving a pat on the back for every time you whack someone with a nightstick? We have to see what is being enforced in the locker room, more so than what's written on the paper.
Michael, I'm just curious, as you've been watching news footage, and of course there's plenty of news footage of protesters, whether they're peaceful, whether they're violent protesters coming up against police officers. What are some of the things that you've been seeing that, you know, you feel like, wow, you know, that shouldn't be happening, or situations that maybe we as consumers of news are seeing that maybe we don't understand because we're not familiar with the situation?
Right. I am a great believer that in situations like the Floyd family or any family who's been victimized by police violence, excessive use of force, lethal force, when they get together with the community and they want to have a protest, a demonstration, their intent is completely peaceful. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The problem that exists is, and we know this for sure, is there are professional instigators, people who travel to come to these things so they know they could generate looting and create opportunities for themselves. There are people who travel to areas where there's going to be natural disasters, and they know there's going to be evacuations and little, if any, police presence. They take advantage of that. And it doesn't take much, even in the most peaceful demonstration. It just takes a tiny spark, because of all the emotion, to turn it violent. It doesn't take much. And so I want people to realize that, one, the intent is usually almost exclusively peaceful, but there are those who take advantage of the emotions for their own gain and light that spark. But also something else. The police have to be on guard. They have to be ready, because then we complain when they don't contain these riots, which could spin out of control easily. So at times when we see a demonstration, if we see officers lined up on the side and they're wearing protective helmets or shields, it's not meant to, and it shouldn't be used to intimidate or antagonize a situation. It's used for their protection and to be ready to respond should something spin out of control. And as long as they behave accordingly, there's nothing wrong with them being prepared. We shouldn't interpret that to be as antagonistic as some people, I think, believe it is.
It's such a different image, I think, when we do see it on the news from sort of police in full-out riot gear versus the images of maybe in smaller cities, depending upon which city, where the, you know, police officers are walking or kneeling with protesters.
Right. And I think those officers, especially the commanders and chiefs who made that gesture, that was awesome. That was a great thing to do. And they should walk with them if they can. Again, we're talking about community policing. Understand their position. Understand their right to protest and have their voice heard. So as we've often heard said, you know, protest is the voice of the unheard. But that doesn't mean, again, that we shouldn't be standing by ready to react. Again, not to antagonize. For example, let's look at what happened in Washington, D.C., prior to the president's photo op. And I don't want to get political on this.
Right.
But
yeah.
I remember
Please don't.
Watching. Yeah, I won't. But I have to call it what it is. I remember watching the demonstration, at least on television, and at least from that perspective, there's obviously things that, you know, the viewer may not have seen. But I saw the protesters standing behind the barricade where they were supposed to be. And I've always been one to say, no matter what, do not get in the face of a police officer. And you see those pictures.
Right.
People getting right up in their face. They're acting aggressively. That's going to put a police officer in fear, and it's going to maybe elicit some sort of response. But take this conversely now, if you remember that moment where the police moved forward to the barricade, got right in their face, and I wasn't expecting the tear gas or the non-tear gas, but I wasn't expecting that, but I said to myself, oh no, this is going to evoke a response somewhere, and a confrontation is inevitable. It's all in sort of the mannerisms and the how you behave.
So let's talk a little bit more. We're speaking with Michael Tabman. He's a national speaker. He's an author. He's a former FBI agent, former police officer, hostage negotiator. He knows this firsthand, which is why we're grateful to have you on the show with us tonight. We're talking a little bit about this defund the police movement, which, you know, realistically in terms of making it applicable in a real way means reallocating funding that goes to police to other organizations. Could you imagine being able to all the situations that police get called for, whether they're like frivolous or life and death situations where people feel that their life is in danger? Will there be a way to differentiate what situation is which, or would you see that the dispatch would have to then send, let's say, for example, a police officer, a social worker, and maybe another type of professional, a psychologist, to when they get a call for help, I guess is what I'm asking.
Right. And that's why I wish they, whoever they are, is or are with defund, use a different term. Mm-hmm. Use reform.
Okay.
We're not going to defund. We're not going to put the police departments out of business. It's not realistic. I look at some of the recommendations on the internet that the council from Minneapolis put out. They think about unarmed officers downtown, sort of officer friendly. Well, that's a great concept until there's an armed robbery or an active shooter. Who's going in? And so to get to your question about the dispatcher, I think it's a great concept, but in reality, we're not going to have psychologists, mental health professionals sitting in the precinct waiting to get called out. They may be on call, ready to go when they need them. So who is the most likely person and the most available person at 3 a.m. to respond to a call? Who's already on the street in their car, able to answer? That's going to be your police officer. Mm-hmm. And again, we're going into an unknown situation. And even though most confrontations are not violent, we know that we walk into someone's home into a civil dispute. As I said, serving a process for a commitment. These are really dangerous situations, and you're not going to want anyone other than an armed, trained police officer to go in there. If they go in and they assess it as, hey, they don't really need me, they need more of a crisis manager, a mental health professional, great. That's great. The officer would rather get back on the street and have that mental health professional called out and respond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you don't see.
I don't think we're going to get away from police response.
Right, being the first responder, that whole first responder scenario. In terms of, we were talking about reform, and you think it should be police reform and not defund the police. Should there be tighter screening for who gets to go to police academy?
Absolutely. We see these bad apples get through. We already talked about officers being disciplined and then rehired, but when I went through the police selection process, again, we're talking 40 years ago, there was a very stringent psychological assessment of me. I took the Rorschach test and was interviewed and asked all sorts of questions. So that's been there for a long time. Whether or not it needs to be improved, perhaps. But we also use a probationary officer or probationary agent period to assess somebody, watch how they handle, and they can be dismissed without cause during that time, if the management doesn't feel they're cut out for this kind of work. But then once you get in there with protections, we have to have this ongoing assessment. And this is where managers need to be trained, need to recognize the signs of trouble. I believe an officer is under stress. I believe the officer is having burnout. They're bringing their problems from home to the job. I think it's going to result in, possibly unnecessary violent confrontation. And they should have the tools to make that assessment, and they should have the authority to make a referral for mental health services. I think there's probably a resistance to do that. Nobody wants to be put in that position. But I think what we see unfolding is going to require that. But I also want to point out that, you know, I being my law enforcement career, I tend to mm-hmm. always give the police the benefit of the doubt. That's my bias. I know that. And I do try to stand up for all the officers out there who are doing a really good professional job. And when we look at these incidents, and they're disturbing, there is no law enforcement officer I know who is defending Officer Chauvin. Nobody. Mm-hmm. I think my reaction when I saw down in South Carolina that shooting, I mean, Mr. Scott, it was insanity. I didn't know what this officer was thinking. But you've heard the number 800,000 kicked around a lot, the estimated number of police officers that are out there. And if you multiply that by the number of man hours spent every day interacting with the public, whether it's service, whether it's mm-hmm. crime fighting, whether it is a violent confrontation where there's an arrest being made, these are still isolated incidents.
Right. Well, Michael, on that note, I've got to let you go because I'm out of time. Michael Tabman, he's also the author of Midnight Sin and Bad Intent. So a little earlier, we were talking with a former police officer and FBI agent, and we were talking about Defund the Police, that movement that you've been hearing a lot about. And we're going to check in with a national reporter with the Washington Post, Derek Hawkins. And we just missed him, so we're going to get him in and talk to him right now. So joining us is Derek Hawkins. Hi, Derek. How are you?
I just fine, G. Great to be here.
Oh, thanks so much for being with us. I know that you are swamped, so we appreciate your time right now. But I think, you know, we talked a bit with a former police officer and FBI agent earlier, sort of about like the practical ways in which, you know, defund the police could actually happen, or in terms of reallocating some of those resources or what that would look like. But can you just sort of update us? Because I think when initially folks hear defund the police, it just seems incredibly radical and downright frightening to a lot of folks.
Yeah, and that's understandable, I think, if you're not familiar with this this movement or this push. So it's, you know, a lot of people hear defund the police, and I think they assume abolish the police or something like that. And in reality, this isn't, you know, a doctrine. It's just a set of kind of general principles that advocates and activists have been promoting for a long time. It's mostly, you know, for years, decades even, it was mostly something that was discussed in, you know, left-leaning activist circles, academic circles. And now it's really been thrust in the mainstream and people are taking it seriously. And what it means is, as you said, reallocating funds that were spent on policing, reducing the reliance on, you know, patrol officers and different, you know, things like gang units and drug units and that sort of thing, and reinvesting them in communities that have been historically underserved, mostly black communities here. And, you know, if you listen to Alicia Garza, the Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. co-founder, defined it really nicely over the weekend. She said, and I'm just kind of quoting from memory here, but, you know, when you talk about defunding the police, it means investing the resources that we were spending on police in communities in need. You know, she said, you know, we want increased funding for education. We want increased funding for health care, housing, quality of life. She said police communities are over-policed. They're over-surveilled. So that's really what's going on here. And, you know, so it's a broad call. And while, you know, defunding might kind of signify one thing for some people, it really means a broader things. And there's not even really a consensus definition, although the general thrust of it is clear, I think.
Speaking with national breaking news reporter Derek Hawkins of the Washington Post. So, Derek, I don't know if you know this off the top of your head, so forgive me if it's fine if you don't. But in terms of percentage wise, is there an average of, you know, how much money generally in cities goes to the police versus other allocations?
That's a great question. And, you know, it's going to vary city by city, you know, in mm-hmm. terms of need, obviously. But in Los Angeles, for example, I think it's substantial. Okay. If you think about the United States government, about half of our budget goes to defense spending. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that in the past 20 years, certainly since 9/11, when municipalities have been incentivized to spend more money on law enforcement and homeland security, that they're spending a lot of money on that. So I'm not exactly sure mm-hmm. what the percentage is, but I know in Los Angeles it's very big. A place like New York has a huge force. I mean, I think there's upward of 45,000 sworn officers on the New York NYPD. So, you know, you can kind of get a rough estimate just by looking at the size of those police forces. Here in D.C., you know, we're only 600,000 or so people, and I believe it's 5,400 sworn officers here. So, and that's a large, that's a very large force, one of the bigger ones in the country. We also have all kinds of different police forces, Capitol Police, Secret Service, military police, FBI, et cetera. So, you know, it's a heavily policed city. Cities are spending a lot of money on this one way or another. So if cities do decide to start pulling from those budgets and putting that money elsewhere, they do have a lot to work with. It, of course, comes at the potential risk of jeopardizing public safety, but this is an experiment that I think a lot of mayors and city councilors are now showing some willingness to consider, at least.
And of course, speaking of experiment, that's what's happening right now in Minneapolis. The latest article that you contributed to on the Washington Post is 9 Minneapolis city council members announced plans to disband the police department there. What are some practical iterations of what this would look like? For example, if other types of, let's say, first responders are created, a mental health person or a crisis manager rather than a police officer, how won't the public have to be retrained, or would a public person be able to differentiate what requires a police officer versus a mental health person? Or I guess, how would it exactly work?
It is a really, it's a tough problem because I think part of the argument that people who favor defunding police make is that policing has expanded so much in the past 40 years that police have basically become social workers. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's a few generations. And you're talking about people who were raised with that expectation, who grew up in communities with that expectation. So I think you raise a really good point that it's a full-blown reimagining that's going to take some reimagining on the part of the public, too. You know, and where do you draw the line between who's a law enforcement officer, who's, you know, some other city service officer? You know, does all that kind of change take place under the department? I know that in a city council meeting last week in Minneapolis, or maybe it was the week before, before they made this announcement, which admittedly was a little vague. They said they were going to end the department. They were taking intermediate steps to end
it. Derek, do you have a? Can you hold for another 5 minutes or no? Do you have to go?
Yeah,
do you have work? Okay, I still want to continue this conversation if you don't mind. We got to do this first and break for news, and then we'll talk more with you if you don't mind holding on with us.
Certainly, I can hang tight.
Okay, thank you so much. Continuing our conversation with national and breaking news reporter for the Washington Post, Derek Hawkins. And Derek, I'm so sorry I cut you off mid-thought there, but you were talking sort of about the practical iterations and sort of that this is a grand experiment that's happening right now in Minneapolis.
It is. And you know what's interesting is the city councilors, or I think many of the city councilors who made this announcement the other day, kind of rode in and were elected on with a mandate to reform. I don't know if they have envisioned doing this drastic of a change, but back in 2017, they were asked during a bunch of candidates were asked during local elections in a voter forum whether they can imagine a city without a police department. And a few of them said yes. And at the time, they were met with some real ridicule and pushback. Well, now most of those candidates are on the council, including the president, and several of them serve on the Public Safety Committee. And so you can see, you know, how this started. And obviously, you know, Minneapolis has, a history of some high-profile in-custody law enforcement, or deaths of black men and women in law enforcement custody. So there's been some rumbling about this for a while. There's been concerns about over-policing and excessive force for a while. And I just think it's interesting that, you know, the city council was sort of galvanized for this earlier, and now, you know, we have this what seems like a watershed moment for not just policing reform, but a complete overhaul of the department. It sounds like Minneapolis is ready to be is ready to kind of take the lead in this experiment, and from what I know, they have a veto-proof majority if they want to move forward with this. There's 12, it's a 13-seat council. There's 12 people on it right now. One seat is vacated. So that would prevent the mayor from vetoing anything they want to do to disband or dismantle the department.
So, Derek, what's the alternative? Have they proposed what who people will call when they're in a dire situation or feel that they're threatened or someone breaks into their house?
I really don't know.
Okay.
And that's a question that's on everybody's mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could imagine, I think it'd be hard for any city, no matter how radical the city council, no matter how willing its citizens to completely do away with police.
Right.
But you can envision a situation where, you know, you start removing lethal weapons from officers. You put an emphasis on community policing. You train police in de-escalation. You have fewer patrol cops. You kind of dismantle the police bureaucracy a bit. There's something similar kind of is happening, a sort of prototype for this is happening in Camden, which sort of dissolved its police department several years ago, but merged it with county police, mm-hmm. and then did, from what I understand, some really rigorous de-escalation training. You know, that's kind of an experiment that's still underway, and I think there are a lot of eyes on that, but this is something totally new. I think one, you know, obvious step that a number of cities are considering, and I'm sure Minneapolis is, this is on the table there as well, is taking away school resource officers, for
right.
example.
Oh, yes.
So these are uniformed officers who have weapons who are policing schools. You know, that's one place where things get shifted away. So it will be really interesting to see, you know, the kind of bits and pieces that we have now about what they're planning. You know, they talked in a city council meeting last week about this, you know, whether they take action to the union contract, whether they use, you know, sort of civilian oversight to sort of steer policing in this in this new direction, whether they shift funds away. All eyes will be on Minneapolis for sure.
What a time for you to be covering this story. I mean, you must just be it's not a complete picture. There's no alternative that they've really proposed. There's no real, like, practical, tangible iterations that they have decided upon yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, it's not clear. It is a crazy time to be covering this. I think, you know, I think back to Ferguson. So I joined the Washington Post the year after Ferguson, mm-hmm. And immediately started reporting on law enforcement. And we've seen, you know, we've seen pockets of this. We've seen, you know, the uprising in Baltimore. Summer of 2016 feels very much like this summer in some ways. You know, that was kind of where Black Lives Matter really took off. There were nationwide protests that summer, some really high-profile police shootings, also the assassination of several officers. Very tense, but there's something really momentous happening right now, and I think the major difference is that this is taking place simultaneously all over the country, all over the world, mm-hmm. and that these massive protests have been sustained, that people are still turning out, and that you're really, you know, we'll see how far the action from officials really goes. You know, there's, mm-hmm. you know, this might not be the watershed moment for policy that some people are expecting, but there's no doubt that the public is seems to be behind this, or huge masses of people everywhere seem to be behind this at the same time. It's a really fascinating time.
And in Minneapolis, the public is supportive of what the council members have decided?
You know, I can't tell, but it's hard. I mean, it's hard to gauge public enthusiasm just on crowd size.
Right.
There's huge turnout there. And again, you do have some evidence that people were willing to try something. You know, otherwise, I don't think they would have, you know, elected a half dozen city councilors who said they were willing to completely reform the police department. Yeah. So there has to be a there,
right,
if I can say
right.
it that way.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Fascinating. As you said, it's a grand experiment, and everyone, all eyes will be on Minneapolis. And we can't thank you enough. We know how busy you are. Derek Hawkins, he's a national and breaking news reporter for The Washington Post. And the latest article that he contributed to is Defund the Police Gains Traction as Cities communities seek to respond to demands for a major law enforcement shift. We hope, Derek, in the future you can come back and join us and update us and lend us your thoughts and your incredible journalism skills. Thanks so much for being with us.
Anytime. Thank you so much. I'm glad to do it.